Welcome to the McLean's Bibliopod for the weekend of September 12th. Today we'll be talking about books turned into films. We'll be joined by former McLean's film critic turned filmmaker, Brian D. Johnson, to talk about his Al Purdy Was Here. And I'll be talking to Salman Rushdie about his new novel, 2 Years, 8 Months, and 28 Nights. I'm Brian Bethune, a writer at McLean's.
I'm Anne Kingston, a writer at McLean's.
First, though, we should take note that the National Literary Prize season has begun with the release of the Giller Long List. Quite an eclectic list, don't you think, Anne?
Absolutely, and one that is really fascinating to drill into in terms of what does it all mean? What is it saying about what the Giller represents right now?
Yeah, I think so. The biggest news, the most obvious thing, is 5 out of 12 titles from small presses.
Well, I think, yeah, absolutely, with Biblioasis being the big winner with 3 nominees this year, Coach House also with 1 and Nancy with 1. But also, it's interesting, there's a 6-to-6 ratio of men to women, and there's a lot of new voices.
Yeah, it wouldn't be the Giller if we weren't talking about who's not there. But
let's talk about who's not there.
Yeah, and there's mention of it, but it doesn't come with notes of surprise and outrage. The first two that come to mind are Lawrence Hill and Nino Ricci, who are both out with big novels after years. Elizabeth Hay, former winner. Jane Urquhart, who was a staple of prize lists for years and years. Their style of novel does not seem to fit this.
I think that's a crucial point, and I think what we're seeing is an acceptance and illumination of plot that new narrative techniques, inventive, the word inventive is used to describe
yes.
Any of these novels. One of the themes I've noticed, and I'm thinking of Andre Alexis's book, which is a canine novel, fanciful book, but there's a sense of magic realism that kind of a through line in many of the books that are up this year, fairy tale.
That's right. These things are fabulous in the original sense.
Exactly.
It's not realistic novels of that sort. It's noteworthy that the Will Lightning Strike Twice Patrick DeWitt train is not yet derailed. I mean, that's a European fairy tale that almost contrasts with Salman Rushdie's Arabian Nights.
Exactly. And looking at the list, I couldn't help but wondering if that particular tenor within the prize list speaks to a larger cultural, you know, Game of Thrones moment where we are returning to kind of more archetypal stories.
I think so, and I think it also fits in trends with international literature. A lot of these books wouldn't be out of place on a British prize list, and there is one British juror and one Irish.
And the other thing, too, I think Connie Galt's book, which is a beauty, is really the only novel on the list that fits the old
sounds like
Giller.
It could be a GG novel. Yeah.
A GG novel in that it's set in Saskatchewan, spans decades.
Yeah.
It is kind of that rural story that used to be the mainstay of the Gillers and Canlit, whereas this seems to be a decided effort to break it open and look at urban stories, look at new ways of storytelling,
right.
and also, again, the new voices.
Also keeps up the Gillers' commendable translation work. It does give us Quebecois literature.
Exactly. So exciting. We'll look forward to talking about the shortlist, which
yes,
is pretty unpredictable at this point.
I know. A long list is roomy, but for the small presses, we'll have to see how the shortlist comes out. Today we welcome to the Bibliopod Sir Salman Rushdie, who may well be the most famous literary author on the planet, if not for reasons of his own choosing. We'll be talking about the state of the world and why his new novel, 2 Years, 8 Months, and 28 Nights, that'd be 1,001 nights, is so rollicking and cheerful a response to it. Welcome to the Bibliopod.
Oh, yeah. It's a new world, the podcast.
It is. Let me ask you first about your situation now. Are you happier in America than you were in the UK?
Well, I've always wanted to live in New York. You know, I've loved New York as a young man, and I always told myself that one of these days I would like to just put myself here and see what happened. You know, I have very deep ties in England, and those aren't going anywhere. But I, you know, I'm happy in New York, yeah.
And what is your reading of the world now, 26 years later, and 3 years since Joseph Anton? because a lot's
happened. Oh, you know, the world is a mess, and if there were another world, that would be a useful place to go, but this is the only one we've got. Oddly, I've always had, as a writer, I've had an instinct of writing kind of against the grain, so one of the reasons why this book came out in the way that it did is that I sometimes think the best possible response to tragedy is comedy. I mean, I think I've often resorted to, let's say, black comedy,
right,
in order to deal with what's happening in the world.
So we can judge your pessimism about the world by how optimistic your fiction is.
Well, yeah.
This is a very cheerful book.
Well, I think, you know, I was interested that people who read it have said that they thought it was the funniest book I'd written, which I, you know. And I mean, I'm flattered by that because, you know, tragedy is hard, but comedy's harder.
Right.
And that even my famously ferocious literary agent, Andrew Wiley, told me that it made him laugh out loud on the subway, which I thought, well, if it could do that to Andrew Wiley.
Well, it's an extremely rollicking story. It's very enjoyable. Can you call it a novel of ideas as well?
Well, I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a level at which it's a, you know, it's a love story and it's a fairy tale and so on. But I think, yeah, it has serious purposes. It deals with the engagement of, you know, various intellectual and philosophical forces. So yeah, I actually think this form, the fable or the fantasy, is a very good form for the discussion of ideas. I think it lends itself to it.
Yes, yeah, I can see that in terms of, because people don't have to do what is expected. They can say things can change that quickly. It is about the mutability of the world.
Yes, and I think that's what. That is what the fairy tale deals with. You know, in fairy tales, there are always very rapid changes. You know, pumpkins turn into carriages.
Right.
People turn, you know, beasts turn into princes or the other way around. You know, grandmothers turn into wolves.
Yes.
And I think what lies underneath that is the sense of a world which is very changeable, which is very mutable. And what I felt is that we live in a time of enormous and bewildering changes, not all of them political. I mean, also, you know, technological. There's this sort of the rise of the information age. You know? The fact that we now are doing a thing called a podcast,
yes,
which even a few years ago, nobody would know what that meant. So we live in this age of incredible shifts in reality. And I think many people feel bewildered by it. Many people feel that the world is full of strangenesses, you know. And so I thought, how would I dramatize that? How would I tell a story in which that sentiment was made real? You know, and the book sort of arose from there.
Well, there's a note of self-mockery in it, too. I like how Ibn Rushdie, eponymous ancestor, being a man of reason, did not recognize what he was dealing with.
Yeah. So. Yeah, well, I mean, self-mockery is always a good thing. I think, you know, if you're going to be a satirist by inclination, and you have to turn that satire against yourself as well, otherwise you're pompous.
But there's also a criticism of a certain kind of rationalism, of smug,
yes,
rationalism that misses, because it doesn't believe in faith, misses its power.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that's one of the things I wanted the book, the quality that I wanted the book to have, that it would not be a simple good-bad opposition, you know, between reason, unreason, faith, disbelief. That would seem excessively didactic. You know?
Right. I was going to bring that up because that's how everyone's casting it, and it's clearly not that at all.
It's not that. It's deliberately more complex than that. That, if you like, the irrational side of human beings includes fantasy, imagination, dreams, and a lot of the things that make life joyful. And the rational side can be very dry and limited. And so even though, you know, if you ask me which side my vote's on, I'd probably have some difficulty because I would think of myself as a person of reason. And yet my books are full of the fantastic. As Walt Whitman said, do I contradict myself? Very well, I contradict myself.
I know. Well, a storm baby keeps coming to mind for me.
Exactly.
Who grows up to be a great judge. No one dares tell a lie in her court.
Yeah.
But she doesn't run into any novelists that I notice. And I was wondering how medieval she would go on the likes of you.
I think I would probably have a really hard time in the presence of the storm baby.
So there are liars and there are liars. Yeah,
I think I'm not sure that the storm, I hope that the Storm Baby is able to distinguish between the kind of lie that there is in a novel and the kind of lie that comes out of the mouth of Donald Trump.
That's right. I wanted to say that. I'm not sure when you wrote this, but you managed to get a note of Trump crazy in there. Well,
I know. It was amazing. It was completely, completely prophetic.
Yes, it was. Okay. And then you have a certain jug-eared president of whom we all expected better. But
but I have to say, you know, you can, of course, it's a kind of mischievous reference to give him the ears.
Right.
But it's not necessarily that president, you know, because the book is slightly at an angle to the contemporary. You know, the mayor of New York is a woman.
Yes.
And the president's race is not specified.
No. And these storms seem to be a combination of Hurricane Sandy and 9/11.
Well, it's a fictional storm. I mean, right. I was actually here in New York during the hurricane.
Right.
And indeed, I was in the blackout area of the city. One of the most amazing things about that storm is there were some photographs that were published, sort of aerial photographs of downtown New York in pitch black. And there was only one building that was brilliantly illuminated. And that was Goldman Sachs. I thought, as a kind of metaphor of our time, there it is. Can't make it up.
Now, I don't know if I have this right, but I see Christopher Hitchens in a certain avant-garde composer. I did want.
Oh, you know, it's very strange because you're not the first person to say that.
Okay.
But actually, I wasn't thinking about Christopher.
Huh?
I think that the character is, if it comes out of anybody, it's based more closely on Harold Pinter. They were both highly articulated, opinionated people.
Yes, with some physical skills for those who disagreed with them.
Yes, exactly.
But he has this moment where the police come to protect him, and they're blaming him for being in trouble. Is that straight out of experience?
Well, I mean, certainly I got to know a lot about the secret police. I mean, it was one of the things I never expected to gain in my life, which was kind of inside knowledge of the British secret police.
Right.
I mean, actually, the truth is, I came to be quite friendly towards them and to admire them for their work and to think they were really good at their jobs. And quite a few of them became friends of mine. So, I mean, I have I think in my own life, I have a much more, if you like, nuanced view of the work of the security forces that I used to. When my memoir, Joseph Anton, came out a few years ago, and when it was launched in London, we invited quite a few of the protection officers who I'd been involved with, and they all came. So suddenly I have, you know, if you need any friends in the British Secret Police, I'm your man.
So the Duniazat, if I'm saying that right.
The Duniazat, yes.
Okay, the bastard offspring of Ibn Rushdie and Dunia. They could have been called the Rushdie.
They could have been, but that would have been obvious.
You're right. But they were sent off into the world with the mark of Cain, namely their ears, and the ability to shoot lightning out of their fingers. And I was wondering if that is much the same as the power of storytelling.
Oh, no, I definitely have the lightning bolts. But you see, that's, again, I'm not telling the truth because I actually have earlobes. So I'm not clearly a member of that privileged clan.
Oh, it's probably just the mark is hidden. You were just being...
maybe a little. But it's not only the mark of Cain. It's also, of course, the mark of magic.
Right.
And actually, where I got that from, just for the record, is that the dynasty that was famous for not having earlobes was the Habsburg dynasty in Europe.
Right.
I mean, all the paintings of the Habsburgs that you'll ever see have these. They have that characteristic.
They have the jaws, but they don't have the earlobes.
They don't have the ears. So I just stole it from the Habsburgs.
You poke at quite a few complex enemies here. There's a little criticism of moderate religion, which also made me think of...
I mean, I think, look, I'm not the person to come to look for praise of religion.
Right.
I never was, you know, I mean, long before anything happened to me, you know, I mean, I grew up in a very, disbelieving household.
Right.
You know, my family, my parents were not particularly religious or at all religious. And so I grew up happily excused religion. And then, of course, I'm a child of the 60s, you know, so one of the things about being young in that time was that religion seemed like a busted flush.
Right.
You know, I mean, the idea that religion would return to the center of the historical narrative would have seemed just comically absurd in the mid-60s.
Yes, it did.
And yet, half a century later, here we are, you know. So one of the many things that we were wrong about was that.
Well, it was Al-Ghazali, who I'd forgotten about. I took enough medieval philosophy to remember Averroes, but
yeah.
I've forgotten the other side of it. He keeps saying, as long as you argue from God, you are arguing in my terms. So
yep,
that's the
right.
Problem with moderation.
I mean, I think it is one of the, you know, I mean, I became very interested in the thought of Ibn Rushd Averroes, you know, because I think the great anguish in his thought is this attempt to reconcile his ideas, his Aristotelian ideas, which are about reason, logic, and science, mm-hmm. to reconcile them with religion, with faith. And it's one of the reasons why, I think, why in the development of thought, he did not really win the argument against the more conservative ideas of people like Ghazali, who is his adversary in the novel.
Right.
And it's a kind of deep irony, I think, about him, that in the end, his thought was not centrally influential inside his own world, but became enormously influential in European thought. You know, so that philosophers like Thomas Aquinas, for example, were deeply influenced by him. And even the 16th century Renaissance humanists of Italy were very influenced by him. So,
in the end, I guess you're talking about dreams.
Yes, I'm talking about dreams. I mean, that's what I do for a living. I write down dreams.
Okay, so we have the idea of putting the audience, the people telling the story, are 1,000 years in our future.
Yes.
So that they can have experienced the downside of their victory?
Yeah, actually that idea, when that was not something that in my original imagining of the book that I had imagined. Right. But when I had that idea, it became, in a way, kind of open sesame to the book. It's what allowed me to write the book in the way that it's now ended up. Because what I thought is, if we sitting here today look back to 1000 AD, what do we really know? I mean, we know some things as facts and some things as legends. You know, I mean, that's the time, roughly speaking, of King Arthur. Did he really exist? You know, was there a round table? But it's also, roughly speaking, the time of Charlemagne, and we know that he did exist and we know what happened to him. So there's a strange mixture of myth and legend, stuff that is clouded in mystery and other stuff that is clear, when we look back a millennium, you know, at the past. And I thought, if my narrator is doing that to us, the thing that I've just said, that we would do if we look back 1,000 years, if somebody's looking back 1,000 years at us, then their knowledge of us would be like that. It would be partly factual, partly mythological, partly fictive, partly journalistic, partly historical. And that allowed me to give the book the flavor of having those things mixed up.
Right, but it also allows you to talk about what's become, what went wrong, and what might unravel. There's the hint of everything, things fall apart again.
Yes, it has a little bit of sort of speculating about the future in it, yes.
And that this future now is not that certain. Again, it's about mutability. You have this absolute victory, and everything is good, and then dreams are what we dream of, if we could.
And so there's a quite serious but at the end. I mean, one of my friends who read it was really shocked by the ending and said, how can you stop there? How can you end it there?
The time of the new strangers, your next book.
And, you know, she said, but I want to know about that world. I want to know about that world that you don't tell us about.
Right.
So,
if you're writing big, fat commercial fantasy, you'd be on to volume two already.
Maybe. I remember my now teenage son telling me at the time that he was younger and reading the Harry Potter books. He said to me, Dad, don't write novels, write series.
Yeah.
And I get it. You know, that's what everybody does who makes a lot of money. So, so who knows? Maybe this will turn into a series.
Okay.
So, not really, actually. Not really.
Are you writing any more nonfiction?
No, I'm so over nonfiction.
Right.
I mean, I think the thing about spending several years writing the memoir, it really more than sated my desire to write nonfiction. And in a way, the fact that this novel swings to the opposite end of the literary spectrum from nonfiction is a real emotional reaction to having spent those years writing the memoir. You know, I just thought, I want to go back to making things up.
A brilliant job of it. One of my favorite reads in quite a while.
Oh, that's so nice of you to say. Thank you. Well, hope everybody listening agrees.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. Appreciate
Thanks
it.
So much, Fred.
That was Salman Rushdie, author of 2 Years, 8 Months, and 28 Nights.
Toronto Film Festival opens this week, and one aspect that's being much buzzed about is the book-to-movie adaptations. There are a number on the schedule, including Emma O'Donoghue's Room, Toybin's Brooklyn. So this is something we're seeing every year, the
right.
attention to the book-to-movie, which raises all sorts of interesting questions.
It does, and so everybody's favorite sort of beating point. I mean, did this work? Did this not work? What makes an adaptation work? I guess for Canadians, the big one would be Emma Donoghue's Room, which was enormously popular and somewhat controversial. Well, we were talking about The Giller before. It was one of the big books ignored by The Giller, though it made the Booker list. It was... I watched the trailer for it, which is very affecting, very moving. I think this will be a popular book, but it was not the book as I remembered it.
But that's you're asking the director to get inside the theater within our brains that occurs whenever we read a book, which is one of the big problems I have in going to see a movie of a book I've previously read,
right.
because I've already created the movie in my head. And I agree totally that Room looks like it's going to be amazing, but that's not how it looked like when I was reading it.
Well, wasn't that what made it feel like not the book as I read is this is going to be a movie about a mother's love, whereas the book was about the push-pull parent and child. I remember when I spoke to her about it, she said every parent swings between captor and nurturer. I didn't see any captor in this trailer.
Well, in fairness, it is a trailer that's trying to sell a movie, and nothing sells a movie better today than the idea of a mother's enduring and undying and triumphant love, right?
And it was a remarkable piece of work that just the way all the articles are gone. It's not the room, it's room. There's one of everything in this kid's whole world.
So what is it that makes a movie... work. I'm thinking, for instance, of Gone Girl, a book that I quite enjoyed reading because of the narrative. But once that narrative kind of was translated into celluloid, it just collapsed. I thought it was a terrible movie. I stand kind of alone on that, maybe not. But what is it for you that, what quality is required to kind of make that transition?
Well, first, it can't insult your visual memory. Though sometimes in genre, it does. The fuss over Tom Cruise playing Jack Reacher in the first Reacher movie, because Reacher is 6'5" and Tom Cruise is not. And it went away. I thought I forgot that it was Tom Cruise and not a 6'5" guy. But I think not insulting your visual memory is very important. Otherwise, you think there is a theme in this. There are very important parts in the book. You remember selectively. And if the filmmakers aren't remembering it the same way, selecting the same high points, then you feel like this isn't working. That's not the book.
But so many people now, I think, are coming to the book after the movie, which poses its own unique challenges.
And sometimes the movie's way better. I mean, To Kill a Mockingbird would not be half as iconic as it is if it wasn't for Gregory Peck in that movie.
Exactly.
And The Godfather was a piece of schlunk as a as a novel, and one of the great movies of the 20th century.
The same can be said for Bond.
Oh, yeah, well, Bond. I mean, the Bond novels are novelizations by now.
Well, let's talk about The Room after we see it, shall we?
Yes, let's do that, and let's see if they did get it after all. We're joined now in the studio by former Maclean's film critic turned filmmaker, Brian D. Johnson, to talk about his Al Purdy Was Here, a documentary about the enduring appeal of the late Canadian poet. Welcome to the Bibliopod, Brian.
Hey, good to see you again, Brian.
So how did you come to Purdy Land? Via making the film, or were you a fan already?
No, I'm sad to say I hadn't really read Al Purdy. I probably couldn't pick him out of a police lineup. It was my wife, Marnie Jackson, who once wrote for Maclean's even before I did. And she had interviewed Purdy for Imprint, and she'd read Purdy back when she was a poetry fan back in the day. And she stumbled across a slim volume called the Al Purdy A-Frame Anthology, which was launched as a way of kickstarting a campaign to restore Purdy's A-Frame cabin in Prince Edward County in Ontario and turn it into a retreat for young poets. And it was full of reminiscences by people who had visited Al's A-Frame, which was like a mecca for the early pioneers of Can Lit. And she thought, I think I'll write a play about Al Purdy. And she started doing that. She did that. But along the way, she was drafted to script and help organize the sort of big event that pushed the A-Frame campaign, the fundraising campaign, over the top, which was a concert at Kerner Hall with people like Margaret Atwood and Gord Downie and Michael Enright and Gordon Pinsent. She came to me to cut a montage of archival footage, doc footage of Purdy, which I did. And I thought, gee, this guy's really interesting. And the day before the show, I said, well, is anybody filming this? And they said, no. And I said, well, even for archival purposes, I think you want to have had that filmed. So I set up a shoot, and then presto, we had footage. And that was the origin of the film. It really developed organically. Like, I didn't say, hey, I'm done with film criticism, now I'm going to be an auteur. No, it was like the story kind of hijacked my life.
Well, what's fascinating about the movie is that it is a movie about poetry, about print in many ways. And I'm curious to know, and also a poet who is considered such a great monumental Canadian poet, but at the same time isn't necessarily known by today's generation, as a scene makes very clear in the documentary. I'm curious to know what it was about, you know, how you translated that, the print, which is very much a part visually of the movie, into the larger cinematography of it.
Well, that was kind of the fun part. The reason I got into filmmaking was not because I was a film critic and I went to see movies. I started making experimental shorts that I saw as poetry, the ultimate expression of writing in terms of concision and beauty and meaning is poetry. I mean, that's kind of the distillation. And cinema, you know, they use the word poetic. People use it all the time to describe things that aren't poetry, like cinema. They say, well, that film was really poetic. What they mean, it was cinematic. So we used, I mean, that was the fun part, was taking Purdy's poems and using sometimes magnified text of Purdy's actual typescripts or manuscripts, which I love to see blown up on a big screen, or to shoot landscapes. Our director of photography, Nick DePossier, who is well known for adaptations of Ed Bertinsky's work, you know, he shot a lot. He shot The Country North of Belleville, which is the title of Purdy's most canonical poem. And to me, there's nothing more pleasurable in filmmaking than sort of taking music and words and landscape and putting them together, which is what we did for that particular poem. And it was partly for artistic reasons that I ended up creating a parallel project called the Al Purdy Songbook and conscripted or asked singer-songwriters to write and record original songs inspired by Al Purdy's work. Most of the people we went to knew Purdy already. Bruce Coburn, he said, yeah, I'll have a crack at that. And I said, well, can I send you Purdy's collected works? I got it. You know, what's amazing about this whole thing is that, I mean, it's kind of neat to direct the movie, but when you send a letter to, you know, Bruce Coburn or Leonard Cohen or whoever it might be, and you say, well, you do something, and then it comes back months later, and that didn't exist before, and now it exists, and you didn't create it, right? This is somebody else's work, but you know that it wouldn't be there if you hadn't created it, and that was really kind of amazing.
One of the fascinating aspects of the movie is Al Purdy's wife, Urith, who is a silent partner in his work and who is given her due, in a way, in the movie. Was she, the sacrifices that were made, obviously, and the costs in terms of her life and her marriage, was that something that surprised you, or how did that evolve?
Totally. At the beginning, I said, well, I guess we got to go interview the widow. know, how interesting could she be, right? And she turned into the lead character. I mean, Al Purdy is the lead character, but he's dead. So, but among our living characters, Urith Purdy became the lead. She's the toughest interview I've ever done. We ended up interviewing her four times. I mean, aside from Tommy Lee Jones, she's the toughest interview I've ever done. Right. But the great thing about the camera is that when somebody doesn't talk, the silences can speak volumes. And her grit and her resolve and her reticence to say anything that isn't true comes across really strongly. And I think she's an amazing character. I just like watching her walking around the A-frame because through her eyes you see the place. You know, she moves in a kind of slow motion, and you can just see the... She's got all these mixed emotions. I mean, on the one hand, she loves the idea of being turned into a writing retreat. On the other hand, you know, she's losing her home and all the memories that go with it. And it's quite sad.
Well,
it's
being taken over by one of your great minor characters, that contractor. He was astonishing.
Duncan Patterson, who's the architect who supervised the A-frame at one point, says, well, we had to find a contractor, and... But it couldn't just be any contractor. It has to be a contractor who reads poetry. Where do you find a contractor who reads poetry? And, of course, this guy, Matty, just bubbled up. And the neat thing about the A-frame thing and also the film is that is to see who just comes in, you know, who walks in the door when they hear about this thing. And it's, you know, I discovered some of the Purdy fanatics, like Doug Paisley, who's a singer-songwriter, who has, you know, 40 volumes of Al Purdy, and met him in a bar in Peterborough when he was a teenager, and things like that. The guy made an impression on people. I feel weird because I never met him. I never met him myself. So, yeah. And here, you know, I found myself, I didn't set out to make the film a record about Al Purdy. I had much more modest ambitions, really modest ambitions. And then about halfway through, I was thinking, geez, you know, this is going to be the documentary of record. And the responsibility felt enormous.
But you're also dealing with a mythology that he had partly created himself, right? And when I'm watching it, I thought of the fact that our most canonical poets, like we're talking Leighton, Leonard Cohen, who is in the movie, have these larger-than-life kind of personas that inform and also allow their poetry to reach a large number of people. I mean, where did you see you were trying to get under that mythology, but it was also one that he almost rejected being part of.
Well, he totally helped create it, and he didn't do anything to really diminish it, except when people say, you know, you cultivate this persona, he would deny that. It's interesting. These guys made themselves into, and they were mostly guys, into kind of rock stars of Can Lit, you know, And Canlit really started with poetry. Atwood, this is not in the film, but at one point she said to me, well, you know, the publishers didn't really want to invest in full-scale novels because there were no such things, Canadian novels, whereas poetry was more economical.
Right. They used to ship them around the country on trains. I talked to Phyllis Gottlieb, who became a science fiction author, but used to travel about as a poet with Leighton and Cohen.
So it was how Canlit was formed, and I think for that reason there's this sense of nostalgia.
I guess the documentary format allowed you to actually pursue one of the themes of the movie, which was Purdy's connective tissue to art that is being performed today. It literally allowed you to document that.
Yeah, in fact, when I started out, I wasn't really interested in doing a biographical movie about Al Purdy. I thought, well, that's been done. We don't need another documentary about Al Purdy. I was interested in the contemporary story. Of course, as time went on, I discovered, first of all, that the Purdy we'd seen in the documentary footage, in documentaries before, had been very, well, censored by Purdy himself, because they would just turn the camera on him and he would tell the story. So there was another story to be told. But I was interested, I'm always interested in seeing how writing, as a writer, see how writing can translate into other media. And I'm not interested in seeing it literally represented. I mean, when I see movies about writers and there's heavy narration or the typing scenes, I don't know, what people try to do to convey what writing is all about always seems so hokey. And I like to see an alchemy where writing is actually turned into something completely different.
Mission accomplished.
Yes.
That was Brian D. Johnson, whose documentary Al Purdy Was Here premieres at the Toronto Film Festival on September 15th. You've been listening to The Bibliopod. Find new episodes at macleans.ca and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and BeyondPod. The Bibliopod is produced by Sarmishta Subramanian. The music is by Stephen Scratt and Asher Lenz. Additional music by Simon Gadke from his album Under the Red, White, and Blue. Thanks to Anne Lavery and Scott Metcalf. If you like what you've heard, try the Macleans Politics podcast on the Hill and our pop culture podcast, The Thrill. Thank you for joining us.